Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Welcome to another episode of the Fell Into Food Podcast. I am your host, Chef Jeff Fell, the soon-to-be number one podcast in the nation. That's right. I want to say a big thank you. We did crack the top 10. It's kind of a big deal for me. So thank you for all that are watching, all that are supporting. Keep continuing to do so. I am actually live in the studio today. My guest, Charles Wong from Umami Q. He is someone who proves that the best path to barbecue pit isn't always a straight line. He spent 12 years in the finance world before trading his spreadsheets for smokers, and that analytical brain has helped him build one of the most exciting food concepts in Chicago right now. He's the owner and pitmaster of Umami Q, where he isn't just smoking meat, he's creating a new language of barbecue by blending strict Central Texas techniques with Vietnamese and Chinese flavors of his upbringing. You might know him from his legendary brisket egg rolls, or maybe you saw him recently take home the $20,000 grand prize on the Utility Show with a smoked duck dish that blew the judges away. He was a 2024 Star Chef's Rising Star. So Chef, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's blistery here in Chicago, a nice negative something with the wind chill out there.
Ooh, yeah, it's frigid. Yeah. But we have a little bit of a break, and then we're gonna get even colder, I think, for the last
I think Friday's negative four air temp with a -20 wind chill, something along those lines.
That's the high, I think.
Yeah, the high for the day, right? Yeah. So you're operating now out of
We're in different kitchens.
All over.
Yeah, all over.
So and I did want to talk about residency because that's kind of what your stitch has kind of been. Think that'll come into some of your past. But talk about, for people that are listening, what is a residency? Like, why you do a residency?
Yeah, so when we first started at Umami Q, it was a catering concept, and we wanted to do, you know, something like a brick and mortar, but we didn't want to assume a whole bunch of risk, especially for me, where I didn't have or I don't have any real professional kitchen experience, but it was just a concept and it was just a dream. So to slow roll that, you could either go into a brewery or a bar that doesn't have their own kitchen. They don't sell food. So one of my partners was good friends with Tony Selna, who was owner of Spilt Milk, and was like, "Hey, do you want to do a residency there?" So we did a tasting menu for him. We really enjoyed it, and then that's what sparked our residency. And it's lower risk in terms of, you know, you don't have a monthly rent that you have to pay. Typically how they work is that you'll give them a percentage of your sales.
Okay.
So top line, you know, so it could be, you know, anywhere from 10% or whatever the case may be, 20%, just depends on, you know, the deal that you strike with them. So you can get really creative with the details,
structures of those deals.
The structures of those deals. So, at the end of the day, it's really beneficial for both, you know, they want more butts and seats,
right?
You know, if you don't serve food at your establishment, your brewery or your bar, when people have that first drink and they're like, "Hey, I'm hungry," like, they're probably going to leave.
Go hand in hand.
I mean, right. Yeah.
It's the food and beverage industry.
Right. 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 So, you know, I saw that as an opportunity, like, "Hey, let's try to prove this concept. And if it works and we're doing something great, then we could progress to the next step, which would have been, you know, the food hall where we'd have our own stall and we'd run it from Monday through Friday, and see how we do there and kind of build from there." That wasn't the end goal. The end goal is brick and mortar. But that was kind of the next progression from a residency to a food hall where we have more of, a presence and more of our own stall.
Consistency, right?
Yeah.
Cause like at a residency, is that you have certain set dates? Is it more like a pop-up where you're just like, "Hey, all right, we're going to do it this day"? How does that work?
So we started off at Spilt like Wednesday and Thursday every week. And then we progressed to Wednesday, or maybe it was like Tuesday to Thursday. And then we progressed from Tuesday to like Saturday. So we were adding on days and then we became a fixture. So you can call it a pop-up / residency, but we were there every week.
Okay.
You know, the downside is you're in someone's space, so you have to be very careful in terms of, you know, you don't want the guest to walk in and say, hey, where is this the Umami Q bar? When it's like, you know, it's not, that's not the case. We're
right.
We're complementary to the bar. So it has its pros and cons, like the pros obviously being that, you know, you don't have to pay a monthly rent, like, you know, $5,000 or whatever. If you sell $10 and, you know, your rent is 10% of your sales and you owe them a dollar, right?
Right.
But if your rent is $5,000, like you sell $10, you're in the red.
And were you using, so, I mean, it's barbecue, it's smoking, right? I've seen your big rig that you got.
Yeah.
Is that just parking it out back and smoking out back? Or is that, I mean, I know there's some complications with the city of Chicago, so maybe walk through some of that.
Wow. Okay. You know, we've been on the run for quite some time. On the run being that you're okay at a location until someone starts to complain about the smoke. So we had that complaint, and then the city did not look too favorably to us for having that. The city of Chicago told us that we needed to put a like a scrubber pollution control device on the smoker, which was nonsensical because there's no electricity on that smoker. It's an offset smoker, so we build a fire in the firebox, and then the smoke and the heat goes through to the cooking chamber, smoke chamber, cooking chamber, you call it. And then it goes out through the smokestack. That's how you produce barbecue. So putting a scrubber on there would mean that we'd have to put something on the smokestack in order for it to filter out the smoke when we were outdoors in an industrial area.
Yeah.
So that didn't really make sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, so we had to kind of move. So we're in a different location now where we're not near anybody. So no one has the opportunity to complain, if you will.
Yeah.
But that's barbecue in Chicago. That's why it's very, very difficult to do Texas-style barbecue in Chicago because you need a lot of real estate to do that.
All right. We're going to go into just barbecue in general, right?
Okay.
Texas, right? You're pretty much like absolute, right? You visited Franklin's, right? Down in Texas, and that's where the whole thing started. And there's a couple episodes out there of, you know, that's kind of what got you into this. But why Texas barbecue?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it the barbecue, right? You've got Memphis, Kansas City, Carolinas. I mean, it's all over, and each person will say why. But for you, what is it about Texas barbecue?
You know, I've tried a lot of briskets in my life, and Texas has the best brisket, and it's taking an uneven cut of meat and making it tender and delicious throughout. And it's really letting the meat shine, so it's really just salt and pepper or seasoned salt and pepper, and then sauce as a complement to it. That's how I like to eat. You know, sauce, I think you can... It's just a compliment. I don't think it needs to go on a good piece of meat.
Yeah.
You know, if you have done it right, where the brisket, when you slice into it and you taste it, it's nice, tender, and juicy, and has a little bit of a sweetness to it, which I think is the best bite. And that blew my mind when I went to Franklin Barbecue for the first time 15 years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago. And then that was like, just mind-blowing to me how it could be so delicious, because I've never had anything like that. And, you know, I go to other places and try brisket, and it's just not the same, you know.
What kind of wood are they using? Or what kind of wood are you using?
We're using post oak.
Post oak, okay. Yeah,
so it's a member of the oak family.
And are you getting that? Is it easy to get that? Is it more difficult to get that?
I would say it's a little bit more difficult to get post oak. You can get white oak. There's a lot of white oak available. I think that post oak, I love post oak because that's what they use in Central Texas, but it's also, I try the white oak versus the post oak, and I feel like it has just a slightly different, almost like a sweeter flavor to the end product.
Yeah, people don't understand that the different wood makes a huge difference on the end product, especially when you're imparting that much smoke, that much flavor. When you're cooking these things, how long do you briskets for?
It can vary. So it varies like based on the temperature outside, humidity outside, the way that you trim the brisket, how big the brisket is.
On average,
anywhere from 12, 14 hours.
Right? Yeah. So you're imparting smoke from a wood source for 12 to 14 hours. Like, it's going to take on that flavor. And it's such a, and it's a big difference probably of actual wood versus pellet, right?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people use pellet because they can get away with the electric piece of it and it makes it a little easier sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But you're doing it the old school traditional, like you said, you're still getting the fire going and then letting that feed into the chamber.
I mean, pellet's how I started, you know, like after I went to Franklin and came back, I was like, let me try this pellet grill from Costco. It was a Traeger. And
hey, you can't go wrong. I got a Traeger at home for my home use. Works just fine.
I love Traegers. I love pellet grills. You know, if you love sleep, rest.
Yes.
You know.
Non-monitoring, stick the probe in. It's connected right to the machine.
Yeah.
And the app, it tells you, hey, your meat's exactly where you want it. And now I can go wrap it or do whatever I want.
Yeah. That is the best, I would say, in terms of if you want sleep. If you want to do it, like, if you want craft barbecue, if you want all the nuances of all the different stages of the combustion cycle with wood, then you do that. But, you know, pellet grills, there's nothing wrong with them. It's great. People who are traditionalists will give you shit for it. Can I say shit?
Yeah, okay. Of course. Well, I think that's with anything in food. Right? Think about pasta, right? I got back from Italy recently, and, you know, the nonas are rolling it by hand. Yeah. And people will just bastardize, are you using a piece of equipment, like for certain types of pasta? And you're like, well, yeah, it just, like, I use a pasta roller. It's a hell of a lot easier than me rolling it out. Like, why wouldn't I?
Yeah, but, 100%.
You know, an absolutist is like, no, it's all by hand. And you're just like, I mean, okay.
Yeah. Can you tell that I rolled it by hand or by a pasta roller? If you can, that's pretty crazy, I would say.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I tell people too that, you know, there's a big, like, debate in terms of, well, is an offset cooker better? Offset cooking is the best, right? Because it's like you have one grate level, you're cooking your meats, you're developing that bark, or do you get a rotisserie, which a lot of the barbecue places here in Chicago do, the successful ones, because it has to be underneath the hood. You have to have a second hood, second shaft in your restaurant. And I'm like, I want to go rotisserie now. I've done cooking with offset and it's great, but I don't think the average person can tell between a rotisserie smoker versus an offset smoker. It's very, very rare that someone.
Well, you're going to get more volume too, right? You take up the same tile footprint, but you're having the same side grates, but now with a rotating, so you can what, 5, 6, 7, 8 times your production?
Yeah, yeah. You can, some of these you can fit 1,000 pounds in it,
exactly.
You know, and probably for me, I can do maybe about like maybe 200-300 pounds if I'm lucky.
Exactly.
So yeah, and it's much easier that. You know, you can build your fire and then you can set it and then you can walk away versus, you know, I'm out in the elements and I'll be doing a cook probably tomorrow. So I'm out in the elements, whether it's rain, snow, like everything affects the end product. So that's where the title pitmaster, because you have to adjust to your environment and you have to know like when to pull the brisket, if you're wrapping or not, all those things are very critical to the final product.
Yeah. Well, labor today is so difficult that you have to be as efficient as possible. Otherwise, you're not going to survive. It's still a business at the end of the day. You still have to. And you have that, you know, you were in finance.
Yeah.
Right. You had that kind of business acumen in the back of your head. You're always thinking about finances.
Yeah.
Is it just you? Is it a one-man team? Or do you bring on, like, when you have these events? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. I have a couple people on the roster that would, you know, help out. You know, when I first started, you know, told my parents that I was quitting my job to do this.
How big did they freak out?
I mean, they were pretty pissed, I would say. But also at the same time, like my first ever catering gig, I remember I had like zero experience. I didn't even have equipment. And they're like, hey, would you like to do a party for 450 people? I'm like, sure. I thought it was a friend pranking me. You know, there, cause I just like signed up for my LLC, got the website,
got
my own like email, you know, charles@umamiq.com. I was like, this is legit now. Someone sends me an email. I'm like, sure, no problem. They're like, okay, send us a proposal. And I'm like, okay, cool. And they said, yes, they gave me a check. It was like a $20,000 check.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa,
this is real.
This is real. You know? And I remember, prepping for the party and, you know, my dad was like, hey, you know, this is just your side hustle, you know, finance is your primary job. I'm like, yeah, that's true. But then, you know, I got burnt out and I'm like, I'm not really doing anything to move the needle. I'm just getting, you know, having unnecessary stress, put on me that I'm like, I don't see the end product of it. I'm not really making a difference in what I'm doing at the time. And I'm like, And I also felt like I was having a heart attack. So I had to go to the doctor and they're like, hey, you got to make some changes. And
usually that's the story when you're in food and you're running a restaurant is that you quit or die because of the stress. So you left finance to come into a stressful environment. However, if it's your thing and you don't view it as, I don't know, just grinding and it's a pain in the ass, then it is a passion. It's a pleasure. And now I can make money off of it. Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah.
So to each his own in what they're doing.
Right.
You know, some people work, again, they have the restaurant, now I kind of burnt out. So then they go and end up working at a corporate job. Or you're in a corporate job and you're burnt out and you go and do your own thing. So there's a lot of paths in this tree. And that's kind of what I like to get at and show younger people in the industry. It's not a linear path. There's so many ways that you can take.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's all these learning opportunities that we like, you know, that I like to frame it as, you know, you can say it's a failure and things that don't turn out that the way that they're supposed to, that you envisioned, you know, you put in time and let's say it doesn't go the way you want it to go. But it's a great time to reflect and understand, hey, what went wrong? How can I fix this next time? What can I do next time that'll make it easier? All those things, it's just problem solving at the end of the day. And those things kind of, you know, I think it drives me to do better and to, you know, put us in a better position to succeed in the future.
Yeah. Let's talk about your menu. I was trying to piece it together from what I could find online.
Yeah.
Brisket banh mi, like, shut the fuck up. Like, come on. Who doesn't want brisket on a banh? Like, explain. I want to kind of go through these because people don't understand. Like, what is banh mi? They're going to hear these Vietnamese type dishes. And and I think the cultural cuisine it's still prevalent. It's still taking its nestle. Americans, I think, or people in America, they want the cultural diversity. They want this blend that's not just fusion, but it's its own entity now, right?
Yeah.
Like, explain kind of what that brisket banh mi is.
So banh mi, it's basically the word banh mi translates to bread. So it was when the French colonized Vietnam, the Vietnamese took some of the French techniques. So one of it was the baguette, and they made it into a sandwich that is super light and crispy on the outside and very, very airy and soft on the inside. So that's the baguette. That's the banh mi. And then you can fill it with whatever you want. Traditionally, it's with pate. It's with some, you know, some meats, and then you have your pickled carrot daikon, your cucumber jalapeno, mayonnaise and cilantro. So that's what we do. So I took it, and on the sandwich itself, you can get our smoked brisket, and then it's our barbecue sauce, QP mayonnaise, cucumber, jalapeno and cilantro, pickled carrot daikon. And then that's what we roll with. And then you can, you know, put other meats on there and, you could dress it up however you like, but I think it's the perfect sandwich because it has those pickles in there.
Yeah.
You know, it has the crunchiness of the fresh veggies. You're getting the fats and the umami from
the light, airy bun.
rich
meat. Like you said, any of the acid from those pickles.
Yeah. And then it's portable too, you know, like it could get messy if you want. But also it could be compact and like you can put it in your backpack, you can go hiking or whatever, and then you can just pull it out and eat it whenever you want. Perfect sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Smoked brisket egg roll.
Yeah. So we, you know, this is kind of like a family recipe. It's usually made with pork. But I'm like, you know, when you're a barbecue restaurant, you're trying to figure out, like, what can I do with the scrap? What if I, you know, if I sold brisket by the half pound, quarter pound, pound, if I have leftover, what am I going to do with that? I can't go back and resell it because it's not going to be as good anymore. It degrades. Mm-hmm. So what can we do with that? We can, you know, chill it, and then we put in a robo-coup to make it like ground brisket, and then that becomes the brisket egg roll. So it has cabbage, carrot, fold it, and, you know, my parents helped do that, especially my dad. He loves doing that because he's retired. So eventually the parents came around. They started helping me because they realized how serious I was with this concept. And we fry it on site.
Just sounds so good.
Yeah, and it's nice and crispy. It has everything. It's just a really good, bar food, you know, especially if you're having a beer and you just want something that's crispy and crunchy and that's going to, you know, satiate you for the next drink cocktail.
There's a burger joint in Rogers Park because I lived in Rogers Park for a little while. I can't remember what the name of it is, but they have like an umami burger, but they have something similar. It's a brisket, egg roll, or a pork, but they only do it like one day a week.
And yeah.
They sell out. That's it. Like you. So if you want it, you have to go early enough to get it.
Yeah.
And then once he's out. And it's just, the time I ate that, I was like, it was like life-changing. I didn't know you could put that inside of an egg.
Yeah.
Smoked crab ragoon. All right. That's kind of a Americanized bastard.
That is
Chinese.
That's the Chinese American. I love crab rangoon. My version is a little bit different. How can I barbecue this essentially? And, you know, when you talk about barbecue, people have their own interpretation. It's like you get your Weber charcoal out, light it, you cook things hot and fast. That's barbecue. Or low and slow for me is like live fire cooking. If you're using wood and smoke, then, you know, that's barbecue. So we take cream cheese, smoke it. So it gets a nice smokiness to it. And then we use real blue lump crab on there. I think like,
wow.
No,
not skipping on
yeah,
the
no,
quality of ingredients.
Yeah. Nothing against the imitation crab meat. I mean,
it's not crab.
It's not crab, but I mean, they call it crab. So, you know, I enjoy it too, like maybe on a California roll. I don't know. But I really enjoy like the flavor of lump crab, just a little bit of scallion. So you can really taste the smoke and you have real lump crab in there and it's a little bit of scallion and salt. And I think, you know, that's great. And then you fold it and fry it.
Are you still doing the crispy Duroc pork belly?
We do that. We do that for catering. So it's really a process. So we get the Duroc pork belly. We cure the meat for a little bit, salt and sugar, and then we smoke it. And then we put a table salt crust on it. And we smoke it until it forms that crust. So it draws out the moisture of the skin. And then you got to roast it in the oven afterwards so it's nice and crispy and glassy. And then it's nice, tender, moist, and smoky for the meat.
Pork belly is just...
Pork belly is awesome. And
the best.
And right now with how like the prices are going, like I was just looking at prices this morning. I'm like, you know, beef prices, brisket prices have gone up 25%. And you know what? Like it'll typically do that in the summertime. Like you're anywhere like four and a half a pound. Now it's like five and a half a pound for brisket. And the yield on that, like my yield on brisket right now is like 45%. So you're looking at my cost without seasoning or anything, without labor, even like the supply wood cost, I'm at like $12 a pound. Right. So if you want to keep your costs at anywhere from 20-30% of your sales, like your brisket price has to be, you know, in the 40s, right?
Are people paying it? I literally had that on my list to talk about beef prices because it doesn't look like any relief till about 2027. That's what they're saying.
Yeah.
So how are you modeling your pricing? You want to be affordable, but at the same time, you got to make margins, right?
Right.
We're not in it to work our ass off and then make, you know, 1%.
Right.
And try and live off of 1%.
Right. Yeah, so we just have to get really creative with the trim. What can you do with that? Make a chili, smoke a burger. If you see a smoked burger on a menu, that's utilizing trim, and that's really, really smart. And, you know, shout out to Leroy and Lewis. They're the ones that started the smoked burger craze that you see on barbecue menus. And, you know, making sausage, things like that, that can add to your margin, the brisket egg rolls. So being creative with that, like we didn't really raise our prices because like the other meats like pork is still really affordable.
Mm-hmm.
So you just try to kind of push those a little bit more so that you can, your overall mix would be fine to hit, you know, let's say 30% for us is good food costs because things are just...
That's a phenomenal food cost.
Really high.
You know, the industry average has always been 33, which I'm like, how has it never ever fluctuated? It's always been 33.
Yeah, but it's hard right now because you're looking at, you know, the pie is 100%, right? So your labor, you want all in costs with like, you know, taxes and everything, 38%, right? So then if you're at 33% for your food costs, then, you know, you're at like 72%, then your rent, cams, everything has to be another 10%.
Yeah.
So you're 88%. So now you're looking at, okay, I have 12% left, right? And in the food industry, if your profit margins are in the double digits, like you're printing money. So if you make a mistake with your finances and your sales are low, I mean, you could be in the red with just 12% left in the pie. So it has to be, you have to be very careful in how you do things, especially now, and, you know, trying to make sure that your staff is paid well so that, you know, they don't leave, but also that they're being challenged, that they feel like it's a great environment to work for, to work in. I think that's really important too.
Well, not just the city, Chicago's minimum wage, what, 20?
Yeah. I think it's going up to like 16 or whatever.
I thought it was higher than that.
I think for the service industry is a little bit different, or tip wage is a little bit different.
Tip wage is a little different, but mm-hmm. I thought the minimum wage was, let's see, oh, you're right, $16.60 for most employees, if you have four more employees.
Yeah.
So it depends on how big you are.
Yeah. And, you know, the issue with that is a lot of these, you know, tip wages, right? Like a year or two ago, the tip wage could be 11, whatever the case may be. Then you make up the rest with tips. The problem is that your front of house expense for the business is going up by 50%. Food costs are going up.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? How do you mitigate that? And you'll see a lot of places that go, hey, we're going into a, you know, instead of having gratuities now, we're doing a service charge. And we did that at Spilt Milk, and it worked out really well that, you know, both my kitchen and front of house, they were making $30 an hour. You know, like with the service charge. The downside of that, it actually cost me as a business owner more money mm-hmm. because instead of it being a tip wage where it goes directly to the employee that, you know, took the order, provided the service, you can share it. But now it goes directly through payroll. So I pay the Social Security tax on it, my portion of it. I pay Medicare taxes on that, or Medicaid. I forget which one it is, but FICA, Medicare. I think it's care. You pay those taxes. So that's another 7-8%
mm-hmm.
that I have to pay out of my pocket, giving the 20% of my sales or 20% yeah, of my sales to, you know, staff, which, you know, they earn, and that's how we do business. But you know, there it has a bad connotation because some owners take it for themselves, you know. You can do whatever you want, but that money is for the business. And you can hear some businesses say, hey, we're going to take, you know, half of that, and 10% we're going to be able to dole out however we want to people, which is fine. It's not how we like to do it, but I know that you have to survive somehow. And as long as you put that out there, like, this is what we do, you know, I think people are more inclined to be like, hey, this service charge makes sense, you know?
Yeah. Two things. One, you pay your staff well. You're not going to have the turnover. And people don't factor in the invisible cost of what it costs if someone leaves and you happen to bring in somebody new. The training, everything that goes with it, right? You can look up any podcast, whatever. They'll talk about it in depth.
Right.
But the cost of it is astronomical. And people don't think about that. They're like, oh, I can just find somebody else. And then you hear these restaurants, oh, we're having labor challenges. What are you paying these people? And then you find out what they're paying, and you're like, well, no shit. Nobody wants to work for you. You're paying them next to nothing, and you expect them to live. It's one thing if they're the young college person, or, you know, in high school, and they need a job, or they're just trying to make some money, make a buck. That's one thing. And that's what a lot of the service industry has provided, a lot of those jobs. But then some people are trying to make a full-on career out of it. And while you can, depending on where you live and all that kind of stuff, you can. But like, McDonald's was never meant to be, you know, unless you're a manager or working in corporate, it's not meant to support a family of four or five. It's not. And
it's
people
not.
Feel like they have the right to demand $20 an hour to work at McDonald's. And it's like, for what? They're so systematized. You literally, like, they plug you in, you flip whatever, you push down the machines.
Yeah.
You don't actually have to really, like, have a cooking background to work at McDonald's.
Yeah. Right. And it comes down to, you know, rents aren't really getting any cheaper as well. When we're trying to look for a brick and mortar, it's been pretty steady. So something has to give, you know, and just not sure, you know, what's going to happen. Like, the backbone of the restaurant are going to be your employees, the people that put in the time, that provide that great service for people, giving them that you know, opportunity to be like, hey, I want to come back here because I want to support. Food's delicious. People really care about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I really feel that people love what they're doing and that this is something that we want to support versus, hey, we're, you know, where I live in the West Loop, like Raising Cane's like went in and a lot of these, you know, chains are coming in because they can't, the local businesses can't afford the rent. And so that was like the Little Goat Diner that left to go into Lakeview and people were wondering why they did that. Well, I think because their rent, and I heard their rent is like 85 grand a month.
I don't know that anyone survives off of that.
So you have to make like, your sales have to be $1 million a month so that you could, you know, make sure that you're making it and being profitable. Now with Raising Cane's, they could look at them like they have so many locations. They're like, you know, this is a loss leader. Like, we're just there for marketing, you know, much like a lot of the restaurant or a lot of the stores on Michigan Avenue, like rent's so high. Like, hey, we're just there because we need a name here.
Or name presence.
Yeah, name presence. So it's like, you know, as a small mom and pop shop or one restaurant, like how do you compete with that? Like,
it's hard. And that's where all the really good food is.
Yeah.
You know, that's where the passion comes through. You feel it through the food. You can taste it.
Yeah.
You go to these smaller places that are ran reasonably well. I've been to some really shitty ran establishments. Taste the food. You can tell the waitress or waiter, like they come out and they're vibrant and they want to make your day. Mm-hmm. And then you know that the person in the back is making the food. And when it comes out, you see it, you taste it, and you can just feel it. I don't know. It's just something about it. You can just taste and feel the love that goes into that food. Whereas once you start getting, you know, bigger and bigger, it's just they're whipping out whatever they can, get it on the plate. And some of those places are great. Don't get me wrong. Like, there's some chains. Like, I love Cooper's Hawk. Mm. I think they do a phenomenal job for what they are, right? An upscale type casual if you want a nicer meal, not break the bank. But they have a lot of systems in place, and they're very successful.
Yeah.
And it's just a good place to eat. So, you know, I don't know where it goes from here with some of the, it's why everyone's closing down.
Yeah.
You can afford, and it's the rent. That's what it is, more than anything, is the rent.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I would say one of those like big, larger places would be Let Us Entertain You. Like, they seem to strike gold with whatever they do. And I mean,
they dominate Chicago specifically. I mean, I know
it's awesome.
Nationwide, but
yeah,
they're huge.
They have great systems in place and everything. You know, it's like, what's the secret to their success? Or,
It's systems. Honestly, I think it's systems. It's putting them in place, finding something that people are willing to pay for. I don't know how you do it in the beginning, because then eventually it turns into buying power at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You're big enough that you can negotiate with the distributor. You can negotiate with the suppliers and say, hey, we're going to buy X amount. What kind of deal you got to cut us? Right. And a supplier that's like, oh, hey, you're going to take, you know, half of our supply. Like,
right.
They're going to make a deal. But why wouldn't they? Because they'd have to potentially go out and get 100 other customers just to fulfill that one slot.
Yeah.
So it makes it hard. Again, on the smaller guy, there's no wiggle room. You
right.
To a supplier. You know, I'm sure they don't really haggle with you. You're like, oh, I sell this. And they're like, okay.
Yeah.
Like McDonald's in one day buys, you know, yours here, like potatoes and like French fries.
Yeah.
Like, I tried to do a deal once and literally got told, you know, McDonald's in one day does your entire volume for a year, right? Like, no, we're not negotiating. And I was like, whoa, there's no buying power. There's no leverage at all. I'm like, well, I guess we're just stuck with what the commodity price is for potatoes right now.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I think they have like a deal in place with, I forget who their supplier is, McDonald's, but they actually like don't have like a signed contract.
Really?
It's kind of crazy. Yeah, because like if they're just too large now, it's like if they stopped operating, both companies would go out of business. Right?
Sure.
Like, so, but yeah, like the buying power is really important. Like I tried, you know, hey, how many cases of brisket? You know, right now brisket is really tough because not only like, you know, like the whole tariff situation, prices going up, the prices aren't like the main thing. Yeah, the prices are pretty high, but also the quality that you get right now. So I remember getting a case. And usually, you know, my brisket cases are weighing anywhere from like 70, 75 pounds. And now I'm getting them at 80, 85 pounds. And there's four pieces of brisket in there. So on average, you're 2.5 to 5 pounds heavier, which makes a huge difference on my cook time. So I'm spending more money
on fuel,
time. Like there was this one time where it took me 16 hours to finish a brisket cook. And that was one of the days that we had like a huge snowstorm, and I'm trimming these briskets. I'm like, damn, like I'm taking off like 2-3 pounds of fat in just this one area. And so the trim is different when we're getting the product. And so we have more waste. And now it's like, what do we do then? I'm like, I don't want to look at this right now. It's like, you know, it's looking pretty bleak in terms of, can I make a profit off of this now that, you know, the average steer is now heavier when they process it.
Mm-hmm.
Like all throughout the entire chain, throughout the entire process, that, you know, it starts from the very beginning. It's like, okay, you have corn, that you have a surplus in corn, you know, these large corporations are controlling the supply. So it's like, hey, if I'm a farmer, like this is the price I'm going to get. It's not directly correlated to what's on the shelves.
Yeah.
It's correlated to like, hey, like this is the price we're going to buy for your steer. You take it or you leave it, you come back later and you're like, well, if corn's cheap, maybe I'll hold on to it. Maybe it'll be a better deal.
Yeah.
But the product's bigger. And when you cut into it and you deliver that product, like, hey, it's not as good to the end consumer, to the restaurant that's processing it, that I'm trying to figure out how can I make this work now that is still delicious and still the same quality for the end customer. And that becomes harder now.
Yeah. I want to talk utility show. Last year.
Yeah.
Took that home. 20 grand. Congrats, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
But you did it with Rohan Duck. So
yeah.
Like, barbecue guy says, I'm going to end our competition, but I'm going to do duck. Talk about how you came up with that dish. What is the utility show? The dish and how you executed on that.
So it was, the utility show is hosted by Tillit, which is a company.
Clothing.
Yeah, clothing out in New York. Great people. And they host a utility show every year. And it's in response to the NRA. Not the gun.
Yes. National Restaurant Association folks.
Yes, yes. So they wanted something more curated for restaurants. Is the NRA, from my understanding, I've never been there before, but it's mainly directed towards more like chain restaurants. So they'll have like robotics and things like that.
NRA is, I've been, I don't know how many years now in a row. It feels like Saturday, Sunday, because it's a 4-day event, right? It's Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday.
Yeah.
It's like Saturday, Sundays for suits to get together and like catch up, right? Because they don't see each other. And it's like the one time of year where they're all in one place at the same time to like show face.
Yeah.
For all the VPs, executives, those that own suits. That's what we're talking about. Executives, VPs, et cetera, for these companies. And they put on this like dog and pony trick show. But then there's like no action. The follow-up is sad. Right? Because some of these big brands, like you have thousands of people coming through.
Eli's Cheesecake, that's one of the brands.
Oh my God. Like Eli's, and the amount of food that they give out. There's no thought behind it. Like you want Eli's Cheesecake, you just go up and you just take cheesecake. There is no conversation about your operation, nothing, unless you truly are interested. But 9 times out of 10, like somebody like an Eli's Cheesecake, they're just like, oh yeah, we're stocked here, and here's our sell
sheet. Yeah.
And then they send you on their way.
Yeah.
Or Nathan's, which they weren't there last year. Ironically, but Nathan's Hot Dogs, they're always there, right? And they have the rollers going all day. And it's just a line. And you go in, you get your half hot dog at any time of the day.
Yeah.
So there's just so much food.
And it's expensive too, right?
It's super expensive. To be an exhibitor, I don't know like all the costs offhand, but working with some brands and they're just like, yeah, they're like the carpet alone in the 10 by 10 section was $20,000. And you're like, for carpet? And like, yeah, if you want the nice cushy carpet, you're paying 20 grand.
Yeah.
That's not for setup, tear down.
No.
Getting the product in. And again, it's Chicago. So you have labor unions that control everything. You can't touch anything. Like if you want to unplug an outlet and plug something else in and they see you, like they'll find you.
Wow.
Like an electrician has to come over, unplug it, and plug it back in because it's electrical work. Or if you're moving water, I've heard stories of guys and they're like, oh, I needed to carry a 2-gallon jug of water to the potable pan wash station. And like someone from NRA, like, what are you doing moving that water? And they're like, I need water. Someone brought it in. They're like, you can't do that. Plumber has to do that. Excuse me? That makes no sense. Anyways.
Wow.
So it turns into this big like trick and pony show. And you know, people think that that's the place to go to like make a name. And like,
yeah,
okay, I saved up enough money and I'm going to have a booth. You save up that much money. Then you're over in Lakeside in the back of the hall. Or last year they opened up. So you've been to McCormick, right?
Yeah.
So you got north side, south side.
Yep.
In Northside, I believe, they added on, like, there's, like, almost like garage doors that opened up on the backside of it, and they opened another section of north. It was like,
wow.
I call it like new north. I was like, I don't even know like what the section was. I didn't even know it existed. They never had it open before.
Wow.
But it's like all these brands that are just trying to get in. I mean, if the people are willing to pay, of course. And everybody's going to say, sure, we'll make room for you. So you're either stuck in Lakeside that nobody wants to walk over to because it's a 10-minute hike from the main halls over to Lakeside. Or you're in the very far back of that new north area and no one sees you.
Yeah.
Because there's just not enough to see. Most people aren't going for 4 days. They're there for a day or two. It's too big to see everything. So all that said, it's just like, yes, can you get some stuff out of it? Yes. Like, especially if you're trying to work with chains, larger companies, like that's usually where they go and have their big meetings. But back to the utility.
Oh, yes. Yes. So, so everything that you explained right there, that's why the utility show happened. So I think it was the second year. They had the utility show, and it's in a small place. It was right by Reggie's Live, which is in South Loop. Really nice venue, and they just had curated events where they had, you know, chefs come in and they would talk about different topics. They had different vendors out there that were selling products, giving away samples. One of the things was this pitch competition where you pitch your restaurant idea. So you know, we had just, you know, gotten out of the food hall. So we were like, hey, now we're a free agent again, and we're trying to look to see what we're going to do. And this pitch competition came up. So I applied. You apply, you basically do a PDF of your business plan. Could be a product, could be a restaurant. So we just did Umami Q, the restaurant. And then we were selected as a semifinalist. So we went up against, I think it was like five others. And it was a 2-day event. So the first day of the utility show was you'd have to make a bite, just a one biter that represents your concept. So, you know, going to Umami Q or barbecue, Chinese, Vietnamese, like how can we kind of mesh all these things together that would give people that perfect bite? And Fortune Fish and Gourmet, they were a sponsor. So they're like, hey, you can use your own product. We'll reimburse you for that. Or we have this catalog that you can get from Fortune Fish. And I'm like, okay, I looked at it. I was like, oh, there's caviar. There's different things. I mean, I was like, wow, that looks awesome. Like, but, you know, caviar is not really in our wheelhouse. Like, so I'm like, duh.
Smoked caviar.
Yeah, smoked caviar, maybe. Just got to cold smoke it. But we're like, you know what? Like, duck could work. You know, I love Peking duck, but, you know, also, you know, like, I like Chinese American food because, you know, I grew up here in Chicago. I was born and raised in Chicago, West Rogers Park, so not too far from where you used to live.
I was right across from Loyola, like right there.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, so
oh, my God. Whatever that side street is, the parking garage that's right there next to Loyola on Sheridan.
Yeah.
Like, I'm literally across the street where the old, I don't know, Five Guys is still there down at the
okay. low
level. I was in that high-rise apartment, literally right there.
Got it. Yeah. That's a great area. Like, lake is so close.
It was. Again, until all of a sudden, like, crazy stuff started happening, and they had to up the police, and me and my wife wanted to have kids, and I was like, we're moving out of the city.
Probably a good idea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway, I digress.
Yeah. Yeah, so, where was I going with this?
Fortune is sponsoring.
Yeah. So we got the duck from them. I'm like, well, I love doing a crispy duck breast. And let's make like a, just like this nice apricot orange glaze on it.
Mm.
And then, you know, in the summertime, my family would eat these lettuce wraps. So we'd have some vermicelli noodles in there. So I wanted to combine all those things together, barbecue, Chinese, Vietnamese, into just this one bite. And so I cold smoked the duck breast, and then I seared it to have a crispy skin on it. Mm-hmm. Then we put on this apricot orange duck sauce, essentially. And then we had... vermicelli noodles with a lettuce on top of lettuce, and then you'd eat that, and it was delicious. I was really, really nervous because we had to do like a 2-minute elevator pitch. We were the last people to go, and one of my partners was like, "Hey, you're going up against two ex-Alinea people from New York,
ooh,
and like they're really, really like talented." And you know, he told me that like the day before. I'm like, why the fuck would you tell me that now? Like, don't say anything to me. Like, you're trying to trick me out.
Wait till we get through this.
Yeah, wait till we get through this. So everybody went through their pitch, and I was the last one. So I was like, hey, what can I, the crowd was voting, like, people. So we had, like, you know, home field advantage because there's people in Chicago that know us. And so I was like, how do I catch people's attention after they're going through, like, different, different elevator pitches? So I started off my elevator pitch. I was like, you know, you want to know how to disappoint your first generation immigrant parents? Like, leave an industry, leave your, like, finance job, your cushy finance job, to go into an industry you have no experience in. People started laughing and people started, like, you know, getting the idea. Kevin Bain was was a part of that first pitch. And then I think Cheryl from Open Table US was, like, the MC. And so they went through and she tried my bite. She was like, this was the best bite of the day. And I was like, such a relief. And then we're voted on and we were chosen as a finalist. So we were, like, top three. So the next day we had to do an elevator pitch. Not elevator pitch. We had to go through a Shark Tank style. So
the panel.
So there are panel judges. Eric Williams from Virtue was one of the judges. And so I had to, the first day was like, that was really nervous because, you know, no industry experience, like, just doing what I love to do. Like, people have techniques down and everything. So, but we were able to pass that. And that's when I felt really comfortable. And I remember that day, that was a Monday, and I was working out before the pitch competition just to get my mind at ease. And I felt really, like, emotional. I was like, I'm really confident right now. Like, I know my numbers. I've reviewed them. I've done pitches before. I've done, like, you know, just presentations. Like, this is where I'm comfortable at right now. Like, this is my wheelhouse. And I was like, we're going to win this. And I went back upstairs and I told my wife, I was like, hey, babe, we're going to win this today. Like, I'm not going to let us down. We're going to win this. And
dude,
it was awesome.
That's amazing. I think with the way the world is in food, like, again, this was just last year. So it's not like we're pretty relevant in speaking about it.
Yeah.
We're still in that. I've had it on now a few weeks. People, the renaissance of going back to just really well-cooked food.
Yeah.
Right. I think anyone can learn to cook, right? You were in finance, went into cooking. It's not like you had this, the traditional, oh, I was a dishwasher at 15 and then I worked my way up the ranks, or me. Like, I didn't, I went to culinary school late in my 20s and went into contract management, completely different routes.
Right.
But if you have a passion for it and you put, I think it goes back to those small mom pops I was saying, and you pour that passion into the food, it comes through. People taste it, and it doesn't have to be all molecular gastronomy and foams and bubbles and you're putting stuff on pillows. You know, God bless the people who did it and helped put food on the map and had its era and its time. But now people just want simplicity that tastes really fucking good.
Yeah.
That's what people want.
Yeah. And those are, like, you know, some of the best ribs I ever had was in Indiana, and a guy was at a gas station. He had, like, just a toe behind smoker, and I was like, this is incredible and amazing. And it's just, like, something that the guy really loved what he was doing, and you can understand that, and you can kind of almost, like, have his point of view when you're trying that. And you know, the second day when I was going through my pitch, I was like, how do I grab people's attention again? And I was like, you know, I talked about, hey, like, we've all shared this one experience, maybe in different places, but we've all had that one bite that, like, transformed us into thinking, like, is this real? Like, I've never experienced this before. And, like, that was my Franklin barbecue experience. And then I went through that and I told the story about how I got started and then, like, what the concept looked like. And then Eric grilled me on, like, my finances. You know, it's like, hey, like, this is what I'm making. And he's like, hey, don't pay yourself 40 grand. You're going to hate yourself at the end of the day. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I've kind of been there, you know? I've been through this.
It's a little hard to live off of.
Yeah. I've been through the spectrum, you know, so, but I'm like, hey, you know, these are the sacrifices that we have to make because, you know, we have to pay other people and we have to be conservative in our pro forma, because there are a lot of things that can go wrong. So, you know, if I pay myself the lion's share of what we're making, this becomes a hobby. If we can't be successful, like, then people are just along for a hobby. And I didn't want that. Like, I want to have like a real business mm-hmm. that, you know, we can be successful and people are contributing to it. So, you know, that's what it takes. So, you know, we saw each other afterwards. He's like, "Hey, man, really great presentation. Love your energy. Let's talk some more." So I got his number. So we got to meet up sometime. And you know, I see the work that he does with mentoring other people, and I think that's great. And that's something that I want to do eventually. You know, I have, you know, people that'll hit me up for like different concepts, or you know, they're like, "Hey, I'm interested in doing pop up. Like, how do I do that?" And like, walk them through it. And like, this is what you should do.
Yeah, people don't understand the finance, which you have a huge leg up on. Mm. Owning a restaurant is probably 75% finance business. Like, it is a business. You have to know how to run it.
Yeah.
You have to have successful labor costs, food costs, overhead, et cetera. Yeah. And if you don't understand that, it doesn't matter how good your food is. How many places have closed because and their food is amazing, but they shut down? Michelin star restaurants, their food is amazing. They shut down because their finances are in shambles.
Like, yeah.
They're spending way more than they can bring in, even if their house is packed every day, because they have terrible, terrible margins.
Right.
You have to know your finances. So anyone who wants to own a restaurant, know your finances, period. Look into it. I know I did originally. I wanted a pizzeria, and I was like, "Oh, hell no." Like, I was like, "I am not putting in the hours, the labor, your own personal labor, what you take for your own time. If you don't account for that, you're going to be miserable." I mean, unless you're, I guess, single, no kid, like, it's just you, and, like, that's all you care about.
Right.
Absolutely. Go for it. Like, you've got the ability. When you start adding in pieces of the puzzle of family and mm-hmm. having a real, like, social life, there's more than just, "I'm going to live at my restaurant for 24 hours a day."
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the toughest thing too is, like, you know, it's fine that you're taking on all the labor right now and you're trying to prove your concept and trying to grow it. At some point, you're going to have to pay somebody to do the things that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I have to pay someone to be the pitmaster. I have to pay someone to, you know, do social media and things like that. And you want people to do that, and you want to pay people who can be better than you doing it. Otherwise, why would I hire this person if I can cook barbecue better than this person, if I can do social media better than this person,
yeah.
if I could do the dishes better than this person? Then, you know, they can't contribute to Umami Q. So finding those people is hard, but at some point you're going to have to pay these people. You're going to have to make enough to pay them. And so that's kind of the challenge. And
that's always the challenge, I think.
Yeah,
how do you replace yourself? Because you've built something.
Yeah.
You don't want to give it up control. You feel you're giving up control, essentially, mm-hmm. to whatever it might be. Again, finance, the cooking piece, whatever it is, and you feel like almost like a piece of you is left. But if you don't, you can't scale.
Right.
And to have a successful business, you have to scale, right?
Unless you have to scale.
Unless you have just a straight service business, which that's, you know, a different model, you know, but for a restaurant, you have to scale.
Yeah. And you have to, and the people that you hire are an extension of who you are. And so really trying to dial that in is really important. And, you know, listening to the audiobook, Unreasonable Hospitality, was great and refreshing to me. I'm like, hey, you walk in, you're like, "Hey, you know, we're not friends." Like, to your like coworkers, like, "Hey, we're not friends, but if we take care of the restaurant, it will take care of you. That is the plan." So think about it from that terms. Like, there's no I in it. There's certain responsibilities that you have to have, but that contributes to the overall success of the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So having that team kind of environment helps out a lot. And, you know, we saw it firsthand with like the Bears this year too, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, hey, like, everyone's held accountable for what they're doing. It's not like, hey, you know, there's the coach and something happened, but nobody took responsibility for the failures or the learning opportunities, right? It's just like, this happened.
So, yeah, it's a learning opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't learn from something, then you'll never get anywhere. So a mistake is not a mistake. It's a learning opportunity. If you view it as such, and
right.
a lot of people don't, they beat themselves up over the mistake.
Yeah.
And they keep making the mistake rather than stopping, reflecting and saying, okay, what could I have done better?
Right.
And if you surround yourself with people that are like that too, I think you have to surround yourself with the right people in order to continue that mindset. If you try to do it on your own, it's a rough, tough road.
And yeah, you can't let the fear take over and like, hey, I'm gonna mess up. Like, that's not a good headspace to be in. But it's like, hey, you know what? This was challenging to me. I'm going to be open and observe like what's happening and why it's not going my way. And that's huge too. And I, you know, tell people, it's like, well, it's not a failure until you stop trying.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, people think, oh, like, I didn't hit my sales number, I didn't do this on time, you know. Okay, but Are you going to continue doing it? If so, then it wasn't a failure. It was a learning opportunity. But as soon as you're like, hey, I'm done with this, like, okay, it's not for you anymore, right? Okay, maybe that's considered a failure, but you do take lessons with you that help you in anything else that you're doing. And I think like everybody should have a restaurant job at one point or another.
Cause, you either work in a restaurant or you should work in retail.
Yeah.
And I've done both.
Because you learn a lot of things. You meet a lot of interesting people. And, you know, it's a lot of it's like, hey, we all have trauma. You know, it happens. And some people have unique ways of dealing with it.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, at the end of the day, we're all just trying to survive and we're all just trying to live. So how can we do that, you know, the most efficient way possible, really?
Wow. We've covered quite a bit. Man, I love it. Anything we didn't cover that you want to talk about?
We're looking for a brick and mortar.
I was going to say, 2026. Yes. What are we looking for in 2026?
2026, we're looking for a brick and mortar. We are, I think we're securing a residency. So what we're, you know, I'm going to Austin in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
So it's just another trip just for some inspiration. But during that process with my partners, we were like, looking at times, hey, when can we go? Because like they're really busy. So like they own like Perilla Fair, Perilla Steakhouse, Nordico. And so like they're like slammed with different things. But they're like, okay, we can go during these 2 days. And we're looking at flights to fly in at a good time so that we could try all the barbecue places. The problem is that a lot of flights land at 11:30. And we're like, well, we're going to miss that opportunity.
Yeah,
like, well, we can go at night and eat barbecue there. And it looked like most of these places are only open from 11 to 3. So why does that not exist here in Chicago? Like, there are no barbecue places that are just lunch only. You know, so we're thinking, like, that's the question we're trying to answer.
Mm.
And so we're like, wait, why don't we do a residency for lunch, 11 to 3, maybe Wednesday through Sunday? So we're working out details, but I think we're going to do that unless we find a brick and mortar, like, soon, which is highly unlikely because you have to look at a lease, you have to then do construction, all those things. So we might be downtown Chicago for residency Wednesday through Sunday in the summer. Doing barbecue.
You have to create a scarcity.
Yeah.
Of people. I think that's why those places are successful.
Yeah.
If you don't come between 11 and 3 a.m. Franklin's, you know, people are lining up at what, 6, 7 in the morning? I mean, I don't, it's early.
Yeah.
If you're not lined up, you're not getting it. And it's that mentality of, if I don't go, I don't get it. And I don't know, there's something about, if I can't get it, I want it even more.
Right.
And it's only such a limited number. And for the operator, honestly, you know what you're going to sell.
Yeah.
Right? I bought this in, I smoke. You know what your costs are going to be. It's not a variable of like, oh, well, you know, only 100 people came in tonight or today. It's like, no, like we're selling out.
Yeah.
And we're only doing X amount of pounds of product. I don't care how many people come in.
Yeah.
If all the product sells, I don't care. If one guy comes in and says, hey, give me, you know, 40 pounds of brisket and that's all you got left. Well,
here you go.
You're out brisket. And that's it.
And the best brisket really is consumed, you know, anywhere from 8 to 12 hours after you're done with it. So, you know, that's that window. Like,
yeah. So brick and mortar for 2026.
Mm-hmm.
Visit down to Texas. Get some inspiration. Anything else on the horizon?
We are doing a collaboration dinner at Stock Manufacturing March 5th. We're collaborating with Guinness.
Okay.
So it's going to be a St. Patty's Day inspired menu. It's a 4-course menu.
I'm guessing there's going to be some corned beef.
We're going to do a pastrami.
Pastrami?
Yeah. So
man,
there's this crazy idea where, over the holidays, I took a flat iron steak top laid and, I smoked it and then I wrapped it in pastry and made a Wellington out of it. Now, we're going to try to do a pastrami with it.
Ooh,
and I'm going to do a rye puff pastry with it. So I'm just working out some details. I'm doing some trials right now. But I think that's going to be like the main course. I think it's going to be incredible. Just something fun that we could do.
Yeah. That sounds
outside the box.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing. Like all the components of what you would want out of a St. Patty's dish, but completely reimagined.
It'll be fun. Yeah.
I love the ability for someone to think outside the box and put something together and then willing to actually take the time to try it.
Yeah.
A lot of things, it's they don't try or they do one trial error and they're like, it didn't work. versus how do we define this, refine it, and make it actually work. So that'd be pretty
cool. Yeah. And we're, you know, I've been making a lot of bread since it's been cold out. So I'm trying to make my own banh mi. You know, so yeah, that's been fun too.
Awesome. Awesome. Hit everybody up on the socials because we want to be able to keep track of these events when you have them coming out.
Yeah.
Best way to get a hold of you, all that good stuff.
Yeah. At UmamiQ. So
UmamiQ.
Instagram.
Instagram. Website, right?
Website.
UmamiQ.com.
Yeah.
We'll have it in the show notes. So don't worry about writing it down right now if you're in the car. We'll get that. Man, Chef, it's been a pleasure having you in.
Yeah,
man,
thanks for having me.
I know
me.
We met at an event and it's... I love the food industry. You never know who you're going to meet. You don't know who you're going to run into, what stories are out there.
Yeah.
And after I learned about your story and listened, I was like, wow, this guy's impressive. Like to go from finance to barbecue. So appreciate you trekking out here to the burbs.
Yeah, thank you.
Come out to the kitchen and chat with me. For all those listening, watching, be sure again, check us out, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, all the usual places. Keep liking, keep subscribing. It keeps me going. All right. I'm a starving artist, if you will, myself, right? I'm figuring this out. So I appreciate it. Go check out UmamiQ. Hit up Chef Charles if you want any of his delicious barbecue because it is amazing. And follow his Instagram to keep track of what he's doing and where he's at. So until next time, we'll catch you on the sunny side. HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.